Hey everyone, it's time for the Image Doctors, part of Nikonian's podcast. This is episode number 51 for October 11th, 2007. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And we are back in one piece.
Pretty much.
From the 7th annual Nikonian's photo adventure trip.
Yep.
And Pat. And we had a blast.
Yeah, we did have a blast. Got some good images, met some nice people, saw a lot of old friends as well. And we'll be talking quite a bit about that today.
Yeah, and so we want to talk about what we did and the whole ANPAD experience from this year and give you all a recap. And then we'll talk about some ideas that we had, especially as it relates to shooting wildlife on the trip that we, thoughts that we had while we were out at 4:30 in the morning.
Right.
In a van with 9 other people.
And we'll talk about what worked, what didn't work, some tips that we were reminded of while we were out there, and hopefully that'll be interesting to you.
Sometimes we even followed our own advice.
Occasionally. We forgot it at times as well, so.
Well, this year's ANPAT was a 2-week adventure, 2 groups, each was a week long, or give or take 6 nights, I think.
Right.
And we showed up for the second week, and we had the pleasure of showing up in Jackson, Wyoming. We drove up there a day early, and so we saw some of the remaining folks from the first session who looked tired but pretty happy, which is generally the feeling you have after a week-long ANPAT. Tired but happy, because they got a lot of great shots, and so did we. And we started off the first 3 days in the Grand Tetons National Park, just outside of Jackson, Wyoming, which is the very western part, northwestern corner of Wyoming. And we mostly were shooting landscapes at this particular location, although there was a fair bit of wildlife, just not as abundant as we were going to see later on at Yellowstone.
Right.
A few of the vans were able to get photographs of moose, but mostly the big tickets were the mountains. And we were lucky in that a storm had come through, and so there was just starting to get some snow on the Tetons. The aspens were pretty much peaking.
Right.
It was about as close to peak as you could get. So that was excellent timing. And so mostly, and then we shot the barns at Moore Monroe.
And Schwabacher Landing.
Snake River Overlook, the classic spots where Ansel Adams was and things like that. Real rich area for landscape shots.
Yeah, absolutely. Along with a lot of less famous spots that were equally good. And I think we've talked about in the past, at least for me, while it's fun to shoot at some of the famous locations, it's almost more fun to shoot subjects that are less often photographed and get some cool shots. And you can certainly do that at Grand Teton. There's
and I'll give
no
you
shortage.
An example.
Uh-huh.
Because I know you have one too, but when you go to a really popular spot, and Oxbow Bend is one of those really popular spots. It's just a spot in the Snake River where you get a really great overlook. And it's just a great spot to see the mountains and the fall colors. And if you're lucky in the morning, you'll get a good aspen glow and possibly reflections in the river around this bend. Well, the problem with that was I was in van one at and our van drew this assignment for the first day. We decided we were going to get out there. And we got up at, we loaded into the van at 4:30 in the morning.
Ouch.
Which was brutally painful, as all of our van one troopers will attest to. We got to the location at 5, and we weren't the first people there.
Yeah.
And within 15 minutes of us showing up, the whole prime shooting area, which is, maybe 20 feet across, was completely filled with tripods. And by the time we left, there was probably 75 photographers all stretched out. And to make matters even more fun, that first day, the sun never came up because we had a lot of cloud cover in the eastern sky. And so we kind of did it for nothing. I mean, we went back and shot it on another day, so we still got to see it. But when you go to a spot that's so popular and well-known, it's amazing how quickly fill up. Like last year when we went to the
Maroon Bells. Yeah.
I mean, we got there over an hour before sunrise, and we had to find a real second-tier spot.
Right.
We weren't in the prime locations.
Now, what's interesting, and this is kind of a lesson learned, is the van that I was in went to Oxbow Bend a few days later, and it was actually a weekday morning. I think you were there on a Sunday morning. And we didn't get there nearly as early. I think we left at 6:15, you know, luxury.
Right.
And we were the first ones there. And there weren't all that many photographers by the time the sun came up. So it was very pleasant, very nice. So I think if you have an opportunity to do some of the shooting at the more famous spots on a weekday morning, try to do it. Shift your trip a little bit if you have that ability, because it does make a difference. And actually, it was a great morning while we were there, so we got nice light.
And we spent that morning freezing our butts off at the Mormon Row Barns, and again, it was a great, great sunrise, just
right.
Windy.
Yeah.
And we were kind of competing with a whole tour group of British folks, but everyone was pretty mellow about it, and we all got good shots from that. And we had a good time.
Certainly patience is an important part of doing landscape work, because you can't control the weather. You can't control the light. Some mornings you're going to go out there and get fantastic stuff. Sometimes you're going to go out and get virtually nothing.
Yeah, and that was one thing we experienced for sure. We went to a lake hoping to get a really interesting sunrise. It was called Jenny Lake. And the sunrise lasted all of 10 seconds.
Right.
The clouds started to turn pink. And then the next thing you knew, they were turning white.
Right.
And it was just bizarre, but that's how it happens. And sometimes, you know, if the sun goes behind the cloud a little bit as it's coming up, you don't get that same kind of light. And we were all left kind of scratching our heads as where the sunrise went. But sometimes that's just how it goes.
Yeah, you have to be patient and you have to be tenacious and get out there and do a lot of shots, because it won't all happen on just one day necessarily.
Now, after 3 days in the Tetons, we proceeded up to Yellowstone from Jackson through the south entrance, and we got into Yellowstone. And the weather when we were there was fairly gloomy, actually. There was periods of sun every now and then, but there was some storms coming through, which made for some interesting but challenging shooting conditions, because with the cooler temperatures, the animals are more likely to come out, as
right.
I'm sure you will attest to.
Yep.
But when you don't always have the warm quality of warm light, it can make things a challenge, overcast skies. So we focused on a lot of the two things we did while in Yellowstone was wildlife type oriented trips, and then some of the landscapes. And the landscapes tended to be things like waterfalls, because there was a fair number of those. The obligatory tourist shot of Old Faithful and some of the geyser pools. And you know, those were a little bit of a challenge when the sun wasn't out, because you don't get the kind of color and vibrant light that you can at other times when the sun is shining.
Right.
But I found myself following our own advice, which was I was shooting these waterfalls and cropped the sky out
right.
on an overcast day. And if you look at any of the shots that I've posted on my website, you won't see a lot of sky in them.
Right.
And it's because that sky was just gray and blown out looking, and it just wasn't worth it.
Right.
Now you saw a whole lot of animals.
Yeah, I think we got luckier than your group did, and it's just one of those timing things. While we were in Yellowstone, we saw single wolf. We saw a bunch of coyotes. We saw elk and bison, moose. We saw a grizzly, and we were at a pretty reasonable distance to the grizzly, so not too far away.
Our van was hell-bent on finding moose and squirrel.
Yeah, moose and squirrel.
But we didn't find either.
We saw bald eagles and got pretty close to at least one of them, so got good shots there. And what am I missing? I'm forgetting at least something.
Did you see some grizzly bear?
Yeah, I think I mentioned it. Black bears we saw in the Tetons area.
Oh, nice.
So that was cool. Yeah, but nice smattering of things.
And we got some interesting shots in our group of bison in the snow, which is, talk about a dynamic range challenge.
That's a nightmare.
I was dialing in like -3, -2 stops, and it still was blowing out the highlights. So eventually I just said, forget it.
And you end up with a black bison.
Yeah. So I eventually said, forget it. I dialed in about -0.7 just to keep, just to make the bison a little darker. And,
coincidentally, that's what I was doing too.
Yeah, and fortunately, what I discovered was using the exposure slider and post processing in NX, I was actually able to recover a little bit of the detail in the snow, and then bring back the shadow detail with a control point on the bison. I know Chris was going to make fun of me for talking about control points. That was kind of a running joke in our van. But they can be quite useful for adjusting brightness and contrast, especially on an image where you've had to dial down exposure compensation. If highlights are blown out, you can't put a control point on a highlight and make it darker. You have to use the exposure slider. Mm-hmm. But you can bring back a lot of brightness from the shadows, and you can recover those using that technique. Mm-hmm. And so that worked out pretty good, but it was challenging. Now, we did see some grizzly bear too, but I don't think we were as close as you are.
Yeah.
The limit on the park says you're supposed to be 100 yards or 300 feet from a bear.
Right.
I think you guys might have been a little closer than that.
Yeah, I think we may have accidentally slipped in slightly closer, like to 200 feet, which it was still a safe distance because of the terrain that we were on, but we were probably a little bit closer than we should have been.
Now, before we go into the next topic, which is going to be shooting the challenges of shooting wildlife at a distance, because this feeds into that, just want to finish off what.
Oh, I should point out
what else
though,
we did on the AMPAT.
Yeah, I should point out we got some wonderful landscape shots in the Lamar Valley area after a snowfall.
Oh, with
and
the snow!
It was great. It was great. Early in the morning, there was a lot of mist hanging around too, so you had this new snowfall and all the bushes and trees and terrain. Coupled with that mist, when you took shots, they, you know, even without doing a black and white conversion, they look like black and white prints, and they had some of the same qualities that you see in a lot of Japanese prints, which I think is really cool, with the background fading into the distance and receding, and very nice stuff. And then we had some intervals where the sun would come out, and you know, get some sparkle going on the landscapes. Really nice stuff. You know, just really, really pretty. So it goes to show you that even when you have some bad weather, that can actually be a great opportunity. You just have to wait around a little while, and oftentimes the sun will come out briefly. Or the other thing is, and I think this is worth talking about, you know, we were talking about how the weather was gloomy at times. Mm-hmm. And when it's really heavily overcast, that doesn't work too well for many subjects at all. You know, you just ended up with no sparkle.
Yeah, so just no punch to the images.
But the thing to watch for is, you know, what I would call a bright overcast condition, which can happen if the clouds thin out a little bit but don't necessarily go away. And that can be really good for things like waterfalls, for wildlife shots, because the contrast isn't excessive, which never works well for those subjects. But it's not all dull and gloomy either. You get some sparkle in some of the highlights.
And one of the things I found in the same conditions was I did a little macro work.
Yeah.
And there were some great fall colors on the ground, and frost and, you know, leaves, fallen leaves. And you can get some real punch to the colors when you're doing macro work on a hazy or overcast, otherwise gloomy day.
Yeah.
It can work out really well. Yeah. And the other thing you brought up was black and white.
Yeah.
And I started playing around with some of my images, converting them to black and white. And on an overcast day, that can work. So what if your sky is kind of because you're just going to make it black and white anyway.
Yeah. It can work really well in those conditions, and you can get some nice shots. I'm very happy with some of them that I converted to black and white.
So we're both actually very happy with the shots that we got on this trip. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's another outstanding week, and seeing everybody was really good. And just getting back together with all the Nikonians again was a really fun time. So all in all, I'd say we had a real successful trip.
Would
you agree?
I would agree.
And there will be an ANPAT, of course, next year. We're looking forward to the 8th ANPAT.
Don't know where it is yet.
Nope. But as soon as that information is available, it'll be out on the website in the forums under the travel and get-togethers section. They will usually create an ANPAT forum, an announcement. So just keep your eyes open over there. Check back regularly. Probably in the next few months, they'll figure out where they want to go and what the group size will be.
Mm-hmm.
So a real fun trip if you can make it.
Yep.
And thanks again to everybody who we met out there. We had a really good time meeting all of you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was in a great van. Really nice people.
Not as good as my van.
I don't know. I beg to differ. Well, let's talk a little bit about some things related to the trip. You know, we had some reminders of past things that we knew and temporarily forgot, and just some challenges and stuff that I think were worth passing on, along with some tips. Mm-hmm. Right.
And a lot of those challenging situations, well, there was two challenging situations that we ran into. You know, one was the light, mm-hmm. because it wasn't always available.
And we've already talked about
we mentioned some
potential solutions,
right.
There.
But the real challenge, especially in Yellowstone, was shooting animals, mm-hmm. With your camera, of course. Mm-hmm. And usually with a long lens. I mean, rarely were we in situations where, I mean, I found myself using a 200 to 400, oftentimes with either a 1.4 or sometimes a 1.7.
Yeah, same here.
And typically there wasn't enough, because it was overcast, the 1.7 was often pushing it.
Now I remember with the animals that I was trying to come up with that you didn't see that we did, and they were the bighorn sheep.
Oh, okay.
And same, the reason I remembered it right now is it is relevant to this topic, but go ahead.
Okay. But one of the challenges of Yellowstone is that there's some really big open spaces, especially in Lamar Valley.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people who are there who aren't photographers, you'll see them with their spotting scopes. And they're looking possibly at wolves or bears three ridge lines over.
Right.
You know, these are things that are like a half a mile away or even farther. Things you can't even see, mm-hmm. Much less with your camera. And if you do, it's just a dot. Mm-hmm. I mean, spotting scopes are much, much more powerful, mm-hmm. than even your longest lenses. Mm-hmm. Now, we were both using 200 to 400 VR on DX bodies, you know, D2X. And that gives you, right off the bat, a 600 millimeter angle of view equivalent.
But guess what?
And then you slap on a teleconverter.
And guess what?
And it still wasn't long enough.
Right.
I mean, that's really what it came down to, is that. And so then all of the things that make using long lenses difficult in the first place start rearing their ugly head. Every tiny little vibration when you're focused on something really far away,
yeah, because
gets magnified, VR or not.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't matter, because you're talking about, you know, a tiny change in angle, you know, an angular change that's minute on the camera, but by the time that's translated over, oh, I don't know, 300 feet, that's a pretty big distance, and things get blurred. So you got to have perfect technique.
Right. And we were working with equivalent focal lengths in some cases of over 1,000 millimeters. That's a lot. That's a handful.
That's a heck of a lot. And then the other problem is getting critical focus.
Right.
And in some cases it's almost impossible.
Right.
The tip that we gave out a long time ago was, you know, if your subject is smaller than the focus bracket, you're going to have a hard time. Well, guess what? A lot of these situations, the focus point was the animal was not much bigger at all, yeah. than the target. Or you would have foreground and background elements, which when you look through a telephoto lens, one of the joys of using a telephoto lens is you get that compression, mm-hmm. of the foreground and background elements. It sort of makes everything look squished together. Well, that's a problem, because now background or foreground elements get into your focus bracket.
Right.
And they cause that problem of where the autofocus system is somewhat fooled. And it's not precisely, you know, so forget focusing on the closest eye of the grizzly bear at 400 yards.
Right.
It just doesn't happen.
Yeah. And oh, by the way, switching to manual focus doesn't really help a whole heck of a lot unless you try some sort of a bracketing approach, because even that can be difficult to get pinpoint focus on. It looks sharp, you know, just letting the autofocus sensor do it, but it wasn't always critically sharp, as you saw when you looked at your images closer.
All of a sudden everything looked just a little soft.
You know, I think both of us are pleased about what Nikon is doing with the D3 and the D300 autofocus system, the new one, because the sensor sizes are smaller again. They're not the really huge ones.
Right.
And I think that will help with this problem. So I think that'll be a benefit, because it is tough, but you're still left with some vibration issues. VR doesn't necessarily solve all of those. So it's just a challenging situation. Inevitably what you're talking about is cropping a photo quite a bit, even with a big gun, just because you can't get that close to some of the animals.
Right.
And now, the bighorn sheep were the exception. That's what made me think about it a few minutes ago. Those are relatively tame, and our van was really lucky. We ran onto a couple bighorn sheep, said, ooh, you know, let's photograph those. And so we went over there, and you can get a little bit closer to them without a problem. They're pretty tame, and they're certainly not dangerous. And then all of a sudden, a whole bunch of others, another eight of them, if I remember right, popped up over the ridge after we'd been shooting the first two for a little while. It included a couple babies and stuff, and it was great. And they were so tame that we didn't go to them. They came to us. I actually had to switch my 200 to 400 out of the mode where, you know, it locks out the minimum
right.
focusing range, because they were coming up, you know, within like 7 feet of me.
I was almost stop using your.
I almost needed my macro lens.
Yeah,
and it was utterly amazing. And so the bighorn sheep ended up being a blast, and they were a lot easier to photograph and get good results on just because of the larger size in the viewfinder. Things like the grizzly and stuff were just tough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and those shots aren't the best.
And you know, it's times like that when you're looking, you know, and you get back into the, you know, you finish the shoot, you know, after a while you've done what you're going to do. And the nine of us would climb back into the A-team van, and we would, you know, of course you start chimping and you look at your images and you start going, gosh, well, these are soft mm-hmm. and these aren't really sharp. And what's wrong here? And I'll tell you, it can really cause you to start questioning your equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, don't. It's really not your equipment. And, you know, sometimes you need that sanity check that does everything really work. So another morning we were at Tower Falls, and this was in the north part of the park, and it had snowed and we saw bear tracks. So we all put on a big lens. We were hopefully going to come across wildlife. Well, we didn't. And so one of the things we thought we would shoot was just the falls themselves off the road. And so we could, so I still had my 200 to 400. So I said, what the heck? I was sort of outfitted at the time for wildlife, so I didn't have my cable release, and I didn't have a whole lot of other things. But I said, "What the heck?" So I'll zoom in and do some real tight shots of the Cascades, mm-hmm. or you know, the waterfall. And there's moss on the rocks and kind of
right,
lichens and stuff.
Lots of cool stuff.
Yeah, just interesting things. But if you want to shoot waterfalls and get that kind of nice, you know, blurred effect, you know, you need to be shooting down and around 15th of a second.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have my cable release. So I put the camera into mirror lock mode and I just sort of locked everything down. I had VR on and just using real careful technique to release the shutter with my finger. I actually got some pretty amazingly sharp shots. You know, I came back afterwards and said, wow, those look pretty good. And here I was at a 15th of a second.
Mm-hmm.
So it just tells you that some situations, it's just really hard when the autofocus, when the target isn't contrasty enough or close enough.
Right.
You know, there's just some situations where even the best equipment isn't going to perform the way you think it might, that you think it might ought to perform.
Right.
And it's nothing against the equipment. It's just there are limitations in this world.
Yeah, so you've got to understand, get them. Your expectations aligned with what's really practical.
And I mean, the
and in some cases, unless you're looking just for a shot that says, "Hey, I saw a grizzly bear."
Oh, I have those.
Right. Everyone did on the trip. That, you know, sometimes it can be more enjoyable just to watch the wildlife and not worry so much about the photo. There are situations like that.
And we all did that. I mean, mm-hmm. you can still use your long lens as a binoculars.
Yeah.
You know, you can still watch the wildlife through your big lens. I mean, when we were out there shooting the grizzly, we encountered a guy with a D2X and a 600 F4,
mm-hmm.
you know, the big Nikon, you know. And I was shooting effectively the same. I was, in fact, I was shooting a little bit more than that because I had I had a 200 to 400 with a 1.4 converter. So we were shooting at about the same
mm-hmm.
focal length. Mm-hmm. He just had a little bit faster aperture. And even then, the bear was not by any means filling the frame.
Right.
You know, and it would have been stupid for us to go out there onto the riverbed and try to get close to Mr. Bear.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you just have to deal with what you can.
Yeah.
But there are limitations to everything, and you have to learn those and not get frustrated by them. And you know, with wildlife, you're still not close enough.
Right.
Now, at the end of that whole thought, you know, we both kind of came to, you know, on our long drive back home, we were talking about this, and we thought about it. I mean, we were shooting the equivalent of 600 to 1,000 millimeters with our D2Xs and these lenses. Had we been shooting a FX format,
like the new D3,
we would have had to have been cropping even more, and it wouldn't have gotten us anything. So there's definitely, I was convinced after this trip that a D300 or D200 or any kind of crop body for a long lens for that kind of shooting is still going to have a very important niche.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because if you're cropping the image, you're going to have to crop the image down from the full frame size. And so you're going from, instead of 12 megapixels down to 5-something or 4-something, you're simply not going to have the resolution you would if you were starting with a DX format camera that's over 12. You know, big difference. You might crop that a bit down to equivalent of 10.
That's still
quite
really
a bit
good.
More. And that will make a difference in bigger enlargements.
And, you know, with respect to ISO, yeah, I kicked the ISO up a few times, but I rarely needed to go to 800. Mm-hmm. There was a few times where it got there.
It would have been nice.
But if I had had a 1600, it would have been nice. So So even if this D300 only goes to 3200, gee darn.
Yeah.
You know, I think the fact that we'll have a very usable 800 and 1600 is going to be plenty for most situations. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times with wildlife, it's not moving so fast that you have to use the fastest possible shutter speed.
Right.
I mean, it helps, but you don't, if you can be shooting 250th of a second, whereas if you're shooting athletes running, you want to be shooting 500th of a second. Mm-hmm. So it can make a difference. Mm-hmm. So we had fun with that. But
yeah, so I think there's some good reasons why DX bodies will continue to be popular.
Yeah, there's
even
no question.
Even independent of the prices that they sell at, they're just some very good rolls for them.
Yeah, and this was certainly one of them. Mm-hmm. You can never have enough focal length when it comes to some of these animals.
Right.
Now, that brings us sort of to the conclusion of our podcast. And
well, no, we have more to talk about.
And we do?
Oh, sure we do, because we're going to talk about some landscape stuff first.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Sorry, silly me. I'm just reading the wrong script. See, those people asked us if we had a script. See, we were trying to follow our script, and then we write the wrong script down, and we don't talk about landscape
stuff. No, because we wanted to talk a little bit about grads and stuff like that.
Right.
A whole other topic.
That whole other thing.
Yeah.
So we learned how important it was to have grad filters again.
Yeah. I knew that.
Well, we knew that anyway. Yeah. And in fact, I bought some grad filters before the trip to finally upgrade to the nice expensive Singray ones. And I had a 2, 3, and 4-stop soft. And I actually used the 4-stop quite a bit.
Yeah, we had some fairly contrasty light, which you do, you know, if you're shooting at higher altitudes.
Oh, and snow on the mountains.
Yeah.
And clouds on the mountains in some cases.
Yeah.
I was using sometimes 5 stops worth of grad filter just to try to get the image in the right ballpark so I could massage it later.
Right. Now, one thing that you ought to think about if you're shooting subjects like we were doing where you had nice reflections in ponds is you never want those reflections to become lighter than the subject at the top. And that's really easy to do if you're not careful with grad filters. You can put too much on the top and end up with a dark sky, nice clouds, but then the reflection is lighter than that, and that's not right. That's not the way things look in nature. The reflection should be a little bit darker than the
subject.
Do they have
reflection-shaped grad filters?
Well, here's what you do, and here's what I did, and that's that you use 2 grad filters, but you have one of them flipped upside down. So what I did is I would position, let's say, a 3-stop hard filter over the sky and the tops of the mountains where there was snow. And then I would take a 1-stop filter, it was a hard one, and put it upside down so the dark part was below, and then have that covering the reflection. And that ended up, you know, yielding a look that looks pretty natural. And I've seen this written up before, and yeah, it's definitely the thing that you want to do. Because that way you end up with you know, trees and stuff in the middle of the frame, you know, being the right kind of tone, and your reflection looks natural.
And that only works with certain kinds of subjects, because if you had another dark foreground element, that you would want that would be in the bottom of the frame.
It could be a problem.
That would be a problem.
It just depends.
But
it just depends.
If you've got the reflection at the bottom, that is a mm-hmm. classic mistake, is to have your too much grad filter on top and then not enough, then the reflection ends up yeah. being lighter.
But it's a trick that can work very well under certain circumstances. And while we're talking about that one stop, I think I may have mentioned this one time in the past, but it's not a commonly used filter, but I think it's a useful one. And one of the ways that I like to use it is as an alternative to a polarizer. And that was one of the things I was doing. If I wanted to darken the sky up just a touch mm-hmm. and bring out the clouds, polarizer wasn't always the right choice because they only work at well at some angles to the mm-hmm. sun.
Correct.
And if you're using a really wide angle lens, it can result in uneven banding in the sky that doesn't look right. And what I found really useful is take that one stop and just position it over the sky. Sometimes I would just hold it there because it's you know not as sensitive to positioning as some of the stronger ones. And that worked perfect. The sky looked completely natural, just a little bit more pop, worked quite well. Now, you can do that with post-processing too, but you know, like a lot of things, if you get the best in-camera
right.
shot, everything else goes better. So don't neglect those one stops. Those are nice situations that, you know, especially after the sun has already come up.
Now you mentioned something though, the polarizer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, on this trip, that thing was indispensable.
Right.
Because with overcast skies, you get a lot of annoying glare on mm-hmm. rivers and lakes and stuff.
Waterfalls,
as well as on foliage.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of those situations that we've talked about where it's good to use a polarizer
right.
were really good to use a polarizer
right.
this time.
And there were a couple times where I forgot my polarizer in the van and was always already well away from it. I was like, ugh.
Curses,
yeah. You know, couldn't get a good shot there. As
one,
a result.
One example we had where I got really good use of the polarizer was at Old Faithful.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the little hike after Old Faithful blew its top. We took a little hike around to some of the hot springs, you know, the other mini geysers and whatever they have there. And there's all these really cool algae and thermophilic bacteria that are bright colors in some of these ponds and in the, you know, the near boiling water. And we had a little bit of sun, but there was still a fair bit of clouds. And that polarizer enabled me with some of these pools to completely remove the reflections. And there was this orange thermophilic chemical eating bacteria in there. It's mm-hmm. this orange stuff. It just kind of just makes cool colors. And it went from looking really dull to just completely saturating out and just coming out with tons of pop in the image, all because I had that little polarizer filter.
Right.
And I actually upgraded my polarizer from my old cheap Tiffins
mm-hmm.
this trip, and I got the Nikon one.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, after using it, it's a really nice design because it's, I mean, they're expensive, but it's a thin polarizer. So you can use it with a wide angle, but it still retains a front filter thread.
Mm-hmm.
So you can put your lens caps and stuff on it. I've had other thin polarizers that were so thin that you couldn't even put a lens cap on the camera if the filter was on.
And they can also be very difficult to adjust because mm-hmm. you just don't get enough
right.
the ring that you can grab with your fingers.
Yeah. So I really like that. I mean, didn't matter which polarizer I had. The fact that I had a nice one this time kind of irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you bring the polarizer on a trip like that is absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about how that if you could only have one filter, that'd be the one to bring. Absolutely held true on this trip.
Yep. All right. So did we forget anything else?
Oh, I'm sure we forgot lots of things because we had such a full week of,
yeah.
you know, we didn't talk about Hateful Helens and all those other cool places where we ate. At least the interesting dining experiences that Van One came across in parts north in Montana, but yeah, I think we've covered all the relevant information for this trip.
Good, so, but we do have a prescription coming out of this, right?
Right, we do, and that was something that you had kind of mentioned in the last episode about your style, but it wasn't really something that I was thinking about as a prescription, and. It has to do with choosing a longer lens for landscape shots, and something like a 70 to 200,
mm-hmm.
or a 105 macro, if you, you know, or 105, something in that longer range, something that you wouldn't think of. And the reason why it was interesting was because where we were, you're pretty far away from the mountains. There's not always a good foreground. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a great dominant foreground element, one way you can achieve a more interesting look is by using a telephoto lens for something like the mountains and compressing mm-hmm. more distant objects to become your foreground. Right. And I did this with a row of aspen, you know, a grove of aspen trees, mm-hmm. and then the mountains in the background. And it really looks like this mountain is just rising up
sure.
from behind him. And it's really easy to forget about the longer lenses, especially when you all set up in a row, you know, like at Oxbow Bend or at the barns at Mormon Row or wherever you might be, some waterfall somewhere. Everyone just immediately says, well, it's time to pull out my 17 to 55 or 18 to 70 or whatever you might have, your wide lens, because that's my landscape lens. And you're using it always at the wide end. You miss a lot of shots that you could otherwise do quite interesting.
Yeah, actually, some of the landscape shots that I was, you know, most pleased with were shot at longer focal lengths, with 70 to 200. I even shot some landscapes, just like you did with the waterfall, with my 200 to 400. Mm-hmm. And they're nice because you focus more on patterns and shapes and things like that. And kind of fun.
Yeah, very fun. And it just, it can help you get out of a creative rut too. Mm-hmm. So that was a good thing. So the next time you're out doing some landscapes, throw your longer lens in the bag and force yourself to try it. And it can, you could be surprised with what you get.
Yep.
Okay, well, I think we've made it to the end. For real this time.
For real.
And of course, we're always looking for people to email us with their suggestions for show topics or tell us how stupid we are or whatever it might be. Whatever.
Maybe not so much of the latter.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if we miss something or if you need to suggest something to us or you want to have a question for us that you'd like to hear answered on the air, we'd be more than happy to do that. Just
and we actually were able to meet some listeners on the trip.
Yeah.
That ran into us on some of the shoots, and that was kind of fun.
So these emails that we get are not just from fictitious people. Sometimes they're actually real bodies behind them sending them. But, of course, the email address is podcasts@nikonians.org. And don't forget, if you are looking for to do your homework on to see what we covered in earlier episodes, all the episodes are listed on the podcast page in the show notes. It's blog.nikonians.org, and just click on the link for the Image Doctors and you'll get all the episodes with what we covered. So you can go back and find that.
And as always, we appreciate the votes on Podcast Alley.
Mm-hmm. And keep up that work, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yep. Bye-bye.